So, yeah, I did want to talk to you last year, but we just couldn't get together, so I guess you're not in the city that often.
I guess that our schedules didn't work out. I was traveling, that was for Knopf last year, and I was traveling mostly Midwest and West, and I didn't get into town a lot, though I'd have wanted to do it.
You've seen a lot of publishing houses over the years, haven't you?
I guess I have,
yeah. Peter Godin is one of your early
He was. Harper and Row. A little publisher in England, Calder and Boyers. And New Directions, who remain one of my publishers even now. I did a book with them in 89, and they're doing the paper edition of Absent Friends, which is a book of stories I published in 89. They're bringing that out in November.
You say Calder and Boyers?
That was my first publisher, but New Directions was my first publisher in America, and we've stayed loyal to each other. They periodically do a book of mine.
Calder and Boyers must be a forerunner to Marion Boyers.
Marion Boyers and John Calder got together. It used to be just John Calder, and then Marion and John were in business together for a while. And then they split up, I guess, as a business, and Marion is back in business as Marion Boyers. I haven't seen her for years. She's an interesting and adventuresome publisher.
Well, she had an office here in New York briefly.
I had heard that. Yeah, I had heard that. I hadn't seen her.
One or two people. Mostly to arrange for distribution from from England.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the closing arguments in a moment, but to lead up to it, maybe you can fill me in on a little of your background. I know that you were born in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. I'm home.
Yeah. Well, what was it like? Did you grow up in a literary household?
Yeah. It was. It wasn't literary. It was educated, and it was smart. And they wanted to be smarter and more educated. My father was a lawyer and my mother a teacher. And there were a lot of books around. And as is true in most houses where both parents are first generation Americans, the children of immigrants, there was a great premium put on learning and on improving yourself by learning. I happened to have been a lousy learner, a terrible student. I was advised not to go to college when I was a high school student. And was probably disappointing in many other ways, too. But
who would advise you not to go to college?
Our high school college advisor.
What kind of advice is that? Don't go to college.
Well, I guess he thought it was a good idea. I had terrible grades. I was very undisciplined. I preferred playing stickball to studying. But when he told me that, in all seriousness, and said, I think you ought to learn to be a plumber. And I went home in sort of shock and told this to my parents. They picked up on it right away, and it was a, I think with him it was sincere. With them, I think it was a gamble, a bluff. And they said, yeah, sure, why didn't we think of that? Go ahead and be a plumber. You don't need to get good grades for that. We can help you go to a trade school. Plumbers make good money. And I suddenly felt that I was being thrown to the wolves. Well, it was very clever of them. And I thought, I must stop this slide. I don't want to be a plumber. I want to, whatever I wanted to be, I knew it wasn't a plumber. And I still can't use a wrench with any efficiency. And I began to study.
I find the advice almost shocking in a way. Because,
well, it certainly was shocking to me.
Well, there I don't know that there's necessarily a correlation between intelligence and creative potential and grades.
Nor who should anyone consider for a moment that being a plumber is a job for a dummy or a kid with bad grades. I mean, I have since come to have, helping to fix up a lot of old houses, I've come to have great respect for people who understand how things work. And you can't be stupid to do that.
Oh, there's a premium on knowledge. And,
yes.
And I've started learning computers or trying to.
I'm about to take the plunge myself.
Well, I am overwhelmed by people who just know these computers in and out.
Terrifying, isn't it?
Look for gurus to help you. Because today I think you learn them in high school and even elementary school.
Yeah, it's useful.
And elderly people, middle-aged people like myself, you know, kind of have to pick it up.
Yeah.
And then you meet somebody and they're usually people in their 20s who just seem to know the computer inside and out and how to work the...
But they can't spell. Because everybody uses their spelling check instead of a dictionary, which is an interesting... I see that in my students. But your remark that there's not necessarily a keen relationship between getting good grades and being good in other ways, whether it is intuitive or creative, is true. And I think it's since the time when I was a kid, I'm 50 now, since the time when I was a kid in the schools in Brooklyn, a lot of people have come a long way towards recognizing that there's more than one kind of intelligence. And I guess it finally hasn't done me any long-range harm that they didn't then. That's worth knowing.
Well, I have a suspicion, just talking to you for these brief few minutes, that that was the kind of advice that you would never give to your students at Colgate.
No, though I've given them some pretty harsh advice sometimes. I've said things like, stop writing, or don't go on to graduate school and dream of being a writer, I have said from time to time to people who were rather earnest about being writers. On the other hand, I've encouraged a lot of kids, more of that, I'm sure, to go on.
Well, couldn't you say something like, you probably will never be able to make a living being a writer?
Well, nobody can ever make a living being a writer.
That's true. But writing is the kind of thing that would certainly enhance your life creatively and give you the opportunity of learning more about words and language.
People who want to write and need to write will not be stopped because a professor with a beard says, don't write. But occasionally you can help divert someone into another aspect of creative work. If you see someone really is tone deaf to language, then there's nothing that you or anyone else will ever do to help them to be better. They just don't have talent. If they understand that you think that, and they then go on to write because it affords them pleasure, I'm all for it. But I have the students I end up thinking about the most are really dedicated. I mean, they are burning to write, and I have to take that zeal seriously and help them weigh it, help them evaluate it.
Well, here's young Frederick Bush, who decides to put aside the potential of a career in plumbing and began to hit the books. You went off to the hinterlands to college.
I went to Muhlenberg College.
Where is that?
That's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's not that far from New York. It's 90 miles or so. I got a wonderful education there.
What did you study?
I was a history and political science major until I met a wonderful man named Bill Kenter, who was sort of half Anglican priest and half poet prophet. And I heard that he read a guy's poetry, if a guy would show him some poetry. So I did. And I was a sophomore then, and he came over to the table where I was sitting in the student union, and he said, you can write, Rabbi. And it changed my life. He and another professor named Harold Stenger, who taught Shakespeare, those two men changed my life. I stopped being a history major. I started being an English major and taking seriously the notion that living with words full time was what I wanted to do. So I'm forever grateful to Muhlenberg College.
You went on to graduate school.
I went to Columbia for 1 year on a Woodrow Wilson fellowship. I was too young and probably too stupid. I had a terrible time. I did my work in the 17th century English poets, the metaphysical poets, and wrote a pretty bad master's thesis. And it was another 5 years before I wrote an acceptable master's thesis. By then I was teaching at Colgate. And I've never gone back to graduate school except as a teacher. Mm-hmm. I don't have a doctorate.
How did you make your living in those early years?
I worked my wife and I lived in New York in Greenwich Village, and I worked for North American Precy Syndicate, a public relations syndicate, which I understand still flourishes to this day in Midtown Manhattan. And I then went on to do some other sort of controlled circulation magazine writing. You know, what I guess I now think of as benign hack work. Judy was then a teacher. She's now a librarian, but she was then teaching. So between the two of us, we kept body and soul together. And ultimately, I came up with the notion that human life outside of New York City was possible. And we began to move on.
you moved on to Colby?
We moved up to Westchester where she was teaching. We lived on the wrong side of the tracks in Harrison, New York. Literally the wrong side of the tracks. And then I applied for jobs at five schools. I just wanted something different from this terrible language I was grinding at. I wanted time to think and to read. My brother was going to Colgate, and I applied to Colgate, among other schools, and Colgate was the only place that gave me an interview, and they ultimately hired me.
You began doing some serious writing around that time.
Yeah. I had been writing even when I was doing the hack work. My writing life consisted of, we had a one-room apartment on Morton Street in Greenwich Village, and with a pretty big bathroom. And while Judy slept, I would go into the bathroom and put the toilet seat down and put my portable typewriter on the toilet seat and sit on the edge of the tub. And I wrote my first novel that way, a really dreadful novel, really, really abysmal.
Was it published?
No, thank goodness, no. The world was saved that one.
Well, James Michener says that's the way, if you want to be a writer, that's exactly what you have to do. Go into the bathroom, put your portable on the toilet seat, and do it after your day's work.
That's a way to do it, and I did that for a number of years. I must say I prefer my routine now, which is quite different.
Well, tell me about your first published work. What was that?
My first published work was a novel, you mean a book. It was a novel called...
I've been
writing stories and stuff, yeah. My first novel was called I Wanted a Year Without Fall. I sent it to a man I was corresponding with in Scotland, a novelist named Robert Nye. He wasn't then in Scotland, but he now is. And he had the great grace and goodness to show it to his publisher, Marion Boyers. The result was that he sent me one of those cables that writers dream of getting. You think it's going to change your life. And I suppose in a way it did. He said, congratulations, Calder and Boyers offers you £200 for world rights to your novel. And so Marion Boyers, somewhere off in England, owns the rights to a really, I think, promising but not delivering novel. And that was the beginning for me.
Was it published in the U.S.?
No, never was.
Did you consider having it published?
No, I think it was an immature book. And I have never read the whole thing, but if I look at a page of it, I think, well, the kid loves language and he shows some promise, but he hasn't yet learned how to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And it took me, I'm a slow learner, and it took me a while to get there.
How did you learn to tell a story?
I just kept trying.
Did you use... guides?
No, I never took writing courses, and I never...
Did you read other writers?
Yes, sir.
Find out how they told
Yes, them? I read everyone I could get my hands on. I knew I was going to be a prose writer when, as I was giving up writing poems and a graduate student at Columbia, I spent much of my Woodrow Wilson Fellowship on books. And I read books by Vance Borjalee and Bernard Malamud and John Cheever and, of course, Hemingway and Faulkner. But those contemporary writers, and I wanted to be like them. And that was the start for me. Yes, I tried to learn, and I still do try to learn, from my elders, my betters, and my peers.
Well, you said something interesting about your first novel, that here's a kid that shows promise because he has a gift for language.
Yeah.
But it does take more than language to have a story that's interesting and compelling and that will hold a reader's attention.
I think so. I think especially in the 20th century, especially in this part of the 20th century, our lives are absolutely dazzling and busy and fraught with bad news and good news pouring in at us. And you're asking an adult to take $20, which could conceivably buy a hero sandwich, or a quarter of a tank of gas, and sit down someplace and stop paying attention to this dazzle and pandemonium and be led to a different world by your voice. Well, you have to know how to tell a story to do that. I had to learn.
It's also more than the interaction of characters, because you have a lot of facts in there that make the story seem real.
For
example, there's information about asphalting in Harry and Catherine, asphalting
a parking
lot or the wetlands and this sort of thing. That,
they
sound true to me. I mean, I don't know anything.
They are true.
But I mean, that's something that you had to do in addition to being able to have a command of the prose and to develop.
That's right. I consulted an expert, David Connell, my brother-in-law, and he sent me stuff to read. And in the case of Closing Arguments, the more recent novel, although I lived through the Vietnam years, spent a number of them trying not to be a Vietnam vet, I had to learn what a Vietnam vet would remember. I had to learn what it was that a pilot of in the Marine wing of the Navy would experience, would see, would know. I had to remind myself of where and how and what Vietnam was and tasted like and smelled like. And I had to learn about the law, because it's a book about a lawyer. It's got a long trial in it.
Well, the courtroom scenes are absolutely convincing, because yeah. I just got off of federal jury duty, mm-hmm. which I was a juror on a insurance fraud case involving Lloyd's of London.
Wow.
And the sidebars, the objections and so forth are absolutely seemed correct to me, because that's what I saw in federal
court. Well, I'm tickled to hear that, and I was thrilled. I've so far had letters from 5 lawyers approving of the book and finding one mistake I made, which I won't tell you about. Why ruin my credibility, which I will correct in subsequent editions.
It's fiction. I mean, so as long as it's not.
Well, I lost track of. I had the judge sustain when he should have overruled, or vice versa. I'll fix that. I loved writing that courtroom section. I felt like I was in a courtroom when I was writing it, and I found it absolutely thrilling, because not only was the lawyer, Mark Brennan, defending the woman he had come to be, I guess, lover to, a very difficult woman accused of murder, dangerous woman, interesting woman, but I felt that he was on trial. In the trial, not only she, and maybe in some way law itself as a vehicle for getting at the truth.
Well, he was on trial, and also as I read the closing arguments, I was concerned about his sleeping with his client, which
yes.
seems to me a breach of professional ethics.
At the very least, also a very dangerous pursuit, and...
But he also... Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I must say what was most important to me, because I've been married to Judy Bush for 28 years, and have striven to keep her approving of me during those years. He was betraying his wife. Though things were coming apart for them, his wife was dutiful and loving to him in some wonderfully heroic
way. Otherwise, but there was never any proof that was.
No, and I think maybe she was driven to another man. Or maybe he needed to think of her as being with another man so he could feel an excuse not to be a loyal lover and husband to her. Could be either. Could be both, maybe.
Of course, Mark, it's Mark, right?
Yes, Mark or Marcus.
Mark also had, as we discover in the course of reading the book, a suicidal impulse, which may be the attraction he had.
Yeah, he has a real... he wants to be punished. And as he dreams back and thinks back and writes memos or legal briefs, really, to himself about his having been shot down and captured and interrogated by the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, rather, he evinces to me a need to be punished. And the punishments that Estella administers when they have rough sex, when she ties him up, when they begin to get into this very dark and frightening stuff, somehow is reminiscent for me of the way he was treated in Vietnam, the way he describes it anyway.
I would assume that, of course, every story has the germ of an idea that eventually ferments itself into a book, but I would assume the idea of rough sex, which has been in the news a lot, and particularly the technique of near strangulation to produce a sexual high may have been an impetus for the book.
I don't remember that.
No?
I remember the so-called Yuppie murder case, the Chambers case.
Island,
yeah, I remember
Long
that.
Island,
I didn't know about the strangulation. That's interesting.
Well, it was the one on Long Island, and I can't remember the participants.
Was that where they wore masks and all that wild stuff?
What they do, I understand. Of course, apparently you don't know about it.
No, I didn't know about this actual case. I certainly know about this technique.
They actually near strangle themselves.
Yes.
And for some reason it produces some sort of sexual high.
It's an autoerotic thing. Yes, I've read about
people,
that.
I understand people, especially young people, have ultimately committed suicide.
Not meaning to,
but it's shocking when they find out. When they're discovered, bodies are discovered.
Yes.
Discovered it was not a
not at all. It was a masturbatory technique.
Yes.
And it's sad for them to be found not only dead, but so vulnerable in their privacy, you know.
But still, that technique is used in closing.
Yes, out. Yes, indeed.
I'd be afraid to do that.
Well, I would be too. I am very pleased to sit here and answer your unasked question. I did not do that research firsthand.
Don't.
There are some things a man will not do for his art.
Well, how does it work exactly? You, as a creative person, you've written 15
novels.
15 novels.
And I'm sorry, 10 novels, 17 books altogether.
Close enough.
Yeah.
You're still a young man.
I hope so.
Lifetime of work, practically, for most people, and tend to do a book every year.
I've done those 17 books in about 20 years, and I've started another one.
It's really an extraordinary output.
I love to write. I know people think I'm being mystical when I say this, but I really do not believe that I've earned my place on the face of the earth unless I've written. And I can't possibly be productive every day, so I have some tough days. But it's necessary to me to write. Whatever my problem is that compels me to write, I'm glad it evinces itself that way, you know, and not in shoplifting or mugging people or something.
Well, I've talked to many writers who passed by these microphones, and they almost all tell me the same thing.
Yeah.
There's something that compels them to do it, because it's not easy. It's lonely. It's something you do. Nobody gets behind you with a gun and says, Fred, write.
No, in fact, I think most people would just as soon pull out the gun and say, all right, skip a book, you know. The world is not asking us to write, it's true. And sometimes the world acts like you're inflicting a bore or tedium upon them when you do write. It's one more piece of information they have to attend to. I believe that the need to tell a story exists in everybody. I don't think everybody needs to be a writer. I don't think everybody needs to be some form of professional storyteller. But I do believe that it's almost as close as you can come to a biological need for a person to, you know, look at you in the morning and say, God, I had a dream last night. Listen to this, and your eyes glaze over, and you begin to fall asleep. But they are telling you the most important thing in the world, my dream. You know, I had a visit from my secret mind last night. Listen to my story. I always think of The Ancient Mariner and Coleridge's poem, the rhyme of The Ancient Mariner. The poem begins with wedding guests, people from the big feast of life walking near the docks. And this frightening-looking old sailor goes up and he grabs him and he says, in effect, listen, I've got this story to tell you. This weird thing happened to me. I was on this boat and I shot an albatross. I don't know why I shot it. And then, I think everybody to some degree has a story to tell and needs to tell their story. And I think more people, more often than not, get pleasure from hearing them if the story is told right and compellingly.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Everybody loves to hear a story, and you're right. Most people like to tell a story, and sometimes it manifests itself so simply as coming home and telling the spouse what kind of day he or she had.
And getting insulted if you're not asked. What kind of day did you have, hon?
You know what happened to me at the supermarket?
Exactly.
You know how rude that cashier.
Yeah.
In a way, you reconstruct the story.
That's right. And it's not.
And embellish it sometimes.
It's not precisely what happened by the time you get done with it, because you're writing yourself as a character when you tell your story. I think we all need to do that.
But you said something interesting. You said you love it.
You love
to write. But I've talked to other prolific writers who say they hate it.
Well, it's very painful sometimes. It can be. It's scary. You learn stuff about yourself. I mean, I have learned, after all, that I am the man who can write a book about a a tough little woman tying a man to bed with shoelaces or ropes and all but torturing him, and yet providing sexual ecstasy for them both. I'm the man who can write about a Marine Air Force pilot who says that when he rides down his tracer bullets shooting people up, they go pop, 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 and explode like popcorn, and he liked it. That's terrible stuff. I've got that in me. That worries me about me, I suppose. So you learn that, and it can be kind of risky, but ultimately the satisfaction of making something, making an object, like making a beautiful bureau or a table or a clay pot, structuring, designing something out of mud and water, is a wonderful and rewarding act for me, and I need to do it.
And I imagine it feels terrific to be able to pick up what you've done, hold it in your hand.
It's great.
Yes, I have done this.
I always make a point of when I have finished a book and I think it's ready, it's in a big black spring binder, and I bring it into whatever creative writing seminar I'm teaching at Colgate, and I hold it up about shoulder high, and I let it fall onto the desk, and it goes boom. And I say to them, that's the feeling that you're after. That's the best part of it.
Hope you have a spare copy of that book so nobody filches it off of your desk.
I keep very, very, very good control over where that goes.
Well, with all of your output, I guess there's no problem about publishing and perishing at Colgate.
Colgate has encouraged me to write as I need to, and it encourages its professors to not only be good teachers or to try to be good teachers, but also to stick their necks out in their field. So it's a nice relationship. Colgate's been terribly generous to me over the years.
Well, I imagine they're extremely proud of you.
I hope so.
It is creative writing you teach.
I teach a lot of stuff. I teach creative writing workshops. I teach a seminar in Dickens. I teach courses in modern and contemporary American and British literature. I've taught Melville seminars. I can do some stuff.
Well, your books have a high literary quality, but have you ever thought about being able to publish a book that just became a runaway bestseller and you could say goodbye to Colgate and just do this full time?
I've never expected that to happen. Were it to happen, I would love to have to contend with that choice. I would like more time to write.
And it happened to John Irving.
Yeah.
He's made so much money with Garp and the other books that he can...
I think it's great fun.
Teaching, which he said he hated anyway. And
I'd certainly teach less if it ever happened. What teaching does do is keeps me honest. You know, makes me read the things I might not have the discipline to reread. That's a good thing. And it keeps me in touch with other people. You can't write all the time. It gives me a community to go to. Would I want to go to it a little less and have fewer books to prepare during the week, things to read, papers to grade? Sure.
Well, if you didn't have that academic community, you'd have to develop a hobby like stamps.
What a dreadful thought. I couldn't do that. I'm too sloppy.
It should be noted before we say goodbye that Frederick Bush is in no way related to George Bush.
I am absolutely unrelated to my president in any way.
Closing Arguments, a beautiful book by Frederick Bush. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.